Tonight on The Download, environmental law and policy center's Howard Lerner, the Smart Museum's John Corbett, and opera singer and Elmhurst native Marcy Stanikis. And now, here's your host, a man who can't figure out how to listen to the new Kanye record, Justin Kaufman.
I feel like such an old man. I'm like, oh, the new Kanye record. What a button do I... Here I thought I was cool. Kanye doesn't want me. That's what I found out. Anyone who listens to this show knows how much I love that guy. But he doesn't want me. It's hard. Well, welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio. Northwestern Wildcats with a loss to the Boilermakers in West Lafayette. Tough. And, you know, we've been talking about it on the show for a while. I mean, they really had to run the table. And they had to at least, you know, we talked about this, have one game in which they beat a superior opponent. Purdue at 20-6, ranked in the top 20 on the road, was their shot, and they blew it. So now they got Michigan coming up, but Michigan doesn't look as good as they used to, so a victory over Michigan may not even matter. It's a bummer. I mean, they really almost, and to be frank, I don't think they get. Do you get an automatic bid if you're the Big Ten champion? Like if you win,
you have to win the tournament. Yeah,
you get an automatic bid because at that point they're always any of those teams that are in, they're always in, right?
Yeah, but so yeah, ostensibly Northwestern is not going to make it. They're on the bubble, but they somehow make a run.
They'd have to win the whole
and
thing.
Win the whole
right.
Tournament.
I mean, at this point, I mean, maybe we're all being speculative, but maybe if they won, if they got to the game and lost,
maybe even got to the game, they'd. Yeah,
because that would. There's so many teams, man. Michigan State, Purdue, as we mentioned, Michigan, Maryland. Yeah, I don't see it happening. It's a bummer because we've been on the show with Joey Meyer, Coach Meyer. We had a lot of expectations for this team for this year to be the year that they sort of break the curse and make the NCAA tournament. Lost tonight in Purdue, not looking good.
There's always next year.
There is. Coach Collins, he was interesting because he kept saying our young guys had a hard time, blah blah blah, or this is the first time our young guys have played. I was like, oh, so they got young guys. That's good. It's a good thing it's not just a bunch of seniors, right? That would be like, oh, man. A bunch of Fab Five. You can get some freshmen in there. Well, great to have all you with us here on a great Tuesday night in February. We're with you till 11 o'clock tonight. What do you want to talk about? Well, we got a pretty diverse show lined up for you. We're going to talk heroin, clean power, Supreme Court, Chicago art, classical music, and staging your confessions. What does Justice Scalia's death mean for President Obama's clean power plan? That's what we're going to talk about tonight. The Environmental Law and Policy Center doesn't want politics to get in the way of cleaning up our environment, but it seems like it's going to. DuPage County officials saved their 100th life using the heroin overdose drug Narcan. Does that mean that they're winning the war on heroin in the western suburbs? Not so fast, but it's a start. And tonight we take a closer look at the fine arts here in Chicago. I'm excited about this, Pete, because I don't think we did it on purpose, but it's just the way that, you know, the flow of a show. Tonight, we just have a real emphasis on the fine arts, on the classical arts here in Chicago. And I'm excited about it. I'm curious about it. As you listen to The Download, you know that, you know, I may not be a scholar when it comes to opera or or the symphony, but I am curious about what happens here in Chicago. And today, or tonight's show is no different. I mean, this is an amazing lineup we have for tonight. We'll talk a little opera, classical music, abstract artists, performance art. MCA Chicago got a nice boost yesterday at the Grammys. Their artist in residence, Eighth Blackbird, won their fourth Grammy. Woo! We'll talk with Peter Taub about the MCA performances, including Speak Bitterness, a six-hour show this weekend that has performers confessing to everything. You name it. That's what they're just doing. They're confessing to everything. And you can come and you can go to watch this six-hour confessional. The Smart Museum in Hyde Park is presenting a new exhibit called Monster Roster, which looks at the collective of artists from the 1950s, 60s. Could this roster be the inspiration for the Chicago style of art? We're going to talk with co-curator John Corbett about that. And I mentioned Eighth Blackbird earlier. They hail from Oberlin College. The college and conservatory has several ties to the Chicago area, and they just brought some of their students to perform at the CSO here in town. We'll talk with Oberlin alum Marcy Stonikis, and who's an operatic soprano, Elmhurst native, and Chicago pianist and current Oberlin student Daniel Hautzinger. So we're going to talk with them about life in classical music. I'm excited. It's going to be great. I'm looking forward to it. So much culture here on The Download tonight. News, weather, and traffic with the culture czar himself, Rob Martier. Esmeralda Leon will be here a little bit later. Production, of course, by Pete Zimmerman. And I'm Justin Kaufman. Here is The Download. All right. Let's get to it, shall we? Why don't we start with Carry Out? This is our nightly segment where I read the newspaper. So you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Tomorrow, Governor Rauner's budget address. You know, that address that talks about the Illinois budget. Wait a second. Budget? What's a budget? Is that a Latin word? Wait a second. Is this something Hillary made up? Such a liar. But seeing that there hasn't been a budget for over 7 months, maybe instead of budget address, we should just call it podium talk. Or how about chatting with the gov? Drop the G. Or how about round and round the turnaround with Governor Rauner? Or my favorite, the clown show. Democrat State Representative Ken Duncan famously went against Speaker Madigan earlier this year, and now the Democratic machine is throwing mud at him as he runs for re-election. A new flyer was mailed bringing up Duncan's domestic abuse history and other unsavory actions, questioning whether or not voters want this kind of character in Springfield. The kicker? This isn't Duncan's first election, meaning the Democrats were fine when he voted their way. Like I said, Springfield, home of the clown show. God! Some politicians are calling for a special prosecutor to take over the Laquan McDonald murder case against Officer Jason Van Dyke. They want it wrestled from the hands of state's attorney Anita Alvarez because of what they say is her cozy relationship with the police union. Alvarez says it's nothing more than politics, since the people calling for the special prosecutor are supporting her challenger, Kim Fox. Wait, Cook County has a clown show too? So many clown shows! Oh, so entertained! Protesters shut down Congress Parkway today, causing huge traffic jams along the Eisenhower. Oh, God. Protesters are like Kanye West. I mean, we get it. We're with you. Stop making it so hard to be with you. The president spoke today, saying he will nominate a Supreme Court justice to replace the late Justice Scalia because the Constitution says he should. Well, the Constitution told you to jump off a bridge. Would you do that, too? In neighborhood news, the McDonald's on Clark Street next to Wrigley Field is being razed on March 1st as part of the renovations around the ballpark. What? Where am I going to get my car towed from when I park there to bolt to Metro? Ah. This, of course, is all about making Wrigleyville more attractive, not just for local meatheads, but for tourist meatheads, too. Rihanna was supposed to perform at the Grammys last night, but canceled due to vocal cord damage. When reached for comment, Adele said, "Wait, you can do that? I didn't know that. I was out of tune. I was so out of tune. It's the piano's fault." That was my Adele. Hello. The cheese police are looking into reports that some Parmesan cheeses, the sprinkle kind, may not be cheese at all. It may be wood. Yeah, but you know it's authentic Italian wood. So I'll say when. Keep going. In weather, the great sloppy snow runoff of 2016 has begun. I'd hate to be Frosty the Snowman this weekend. Oh, no, Wendy, I'm melting.
Ha-ha, gotcha, Frosty.
In sports, pitchers and catchers report this weekend. Woo-hoo, can you believe it? I'm so psyched for 6 weeks of meaningless practice and sports announcers in rayon shirts and cargo shorts doing live shots by their hotel pools. Ah, spring training. Former White Sox hero Mark Burley is not currently on a team, and he's mulling retirement. Wait, he can't take a pay cut and be ready to step in for Chris Sale's annual trip to the DL? Sorry, but you know what's going to happen. The Bears released left tackle Jermont Bushrod today. He came in a couple of years back as a savior for our offensive line woes, but he ended up on the bench, cut with little fanfare. Don't matter. I mean, Kyle Long can play his position, too. Play them all. NBA trade deadline is Thursday night, and one trade heating up would send Taj Gibson out of town to Toronto, which would suck because I'm so close to finishing my new poster, the Taj Mahal, which has him dunking the ball, wearing a sari with the Taj Mahal in the background. I just cleared the rights. It was so hard with the Indian government. It's just my luck. And Northwestern loses to Purdue tonight, which means I have to stop writing my new book, Cinderella Season, How the Northwestern Wildcats Overcame the Odds for Their First NCAA Tournament Ever. Ugh. And I had the first couple paragraphs already written. And finally, the Shedd Aquarium welcomed a rescued sea otter pup from Monterey. I guess El Nino hates cute.
But we are excited to have you here, Baby Otter, and we'd like to welcome you the way we welcome all new sea creatures to Chicago via song. So shed people, put the speaker up to the tank, for I, Justin Kaufman, will serenade. You are my fire, the one desire, blah, blah, blah. I want it that way. So tell me why, little baby otter, you're here. Tell me why you got so cute, cute whiskers. Tell me why you always slide down on your back. Sea otter, we want you that way. Sea otter, welcome to Chicago. We love you, Sea Otter Pup. Well, that's the carryout for February 16, 2016. Hey, who ordered the poppers? We're out of the cream cheese ones. Sorry, they turned.
I think I might have done my best Adele right there. A little bit out of tune, but that's okay. I hope the little sea otter is comfortable. I hope you like that song. Coming up, Howard Lerner's here. We're going to talk about the clean power plan. Will it be affected by the death of Justice Scalia? We'll talk about it. It's a download. Stay with us. All right, so Howard Lerner coming up. But before we get there, Pete, did you by chance download the Kanye West record?
No, I just listen to samples. Get a little terrible taste.
I did the same. I was so excited about it. I hook, line, and sinker into the marketing of it. Mm-hmm. I love that it took 3 or 4 days. I love it.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh, this is great. And then I'm like, well, I'm not a title subscriber, and I don't really feel like I just have subscriber fatigue in the way that I don't want another thing. So I'm just like, I don't know. I was not. Going to do it that way. So then I went to his website. I'm like, I listen to that stuff. And there's, I don't know, man. I think he's trying to get me to not like him. Yasmin Bey, who is Mos Def, has a voicemail that they put on. You can't do anything. You go to KanyeWest.com and it plays a 4-minute voicemail about how he can't get back in the country.
Mm-hmm.
He's for anyone who doesn't know who Mos Def is, he's an actor and a rapper and he's great. But it's this ramble.
You don't want to listen to that when you're trying to download a record.
Corner. I just want to listen to the music, and I can't get to the music till after. And I've now tried it 3 times, and I've shut it off every time. I'm like, you can't have my ears.
Do you get a little further with each listen? Like, I can listen.
I've gotten to the point about the South African government. Something in there that Yasmin Bey is talking about, and how he just wants to be able to travel. So yeah, I got that far.
I went to Tidal because, I'm interested in hearing it, and it says, try it now. I'm like, oh, all right, I'll try it now to listen to the album.
Right.
But then, you hit try it now, and it's like $17.99 a month or whatever. Right. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to try it.
Try it now with your email. Right. Give us your give us your 4 digits of your social security number. Yeah.
So I'll download it illegally, like a billion people apparently have done so far.
Are they really? Kanye is going to be so mad at you. He's going to tweet at you so bad, Pete. Rob, did you get the Kanye West record?
To say that I'm mildly interested would be an overstatement, but I will donate to his Kickstarter fund because I understand he's got some debt problems.
Right. Well, I have a problem with that story, Rob. You're a newsman. So we're going off of a tweet.
Right.
That Kanye
his
West,
tweet.
His tweet.
Yes.
And he said he's in debt, and now people are writing articles and all this stuff around the debt of Kanye West based on Kanye West telling us on Twitter. I don't know. I kind of feel like, is there, what's that old adage, check what your mom says second time?
Well, look, as a man of little journalistic integrity, I did find the tweet a bit skeptical. Is he in debt? I don't know. But $53 million in debt? I highly doubt it.
Maybe he's counting mortgages. Maybe he has like 19 houses or something.
Well, it's possible. Those Bugattis, you got a few of those.
Yeah,
it adds up quickly.
Right.
Yeah.
It's Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up at 11. She is in Springfield. Tomorrow's the big budget address. As I said, needs a new name since there's no budget. Governor Rauner will, I believe that it's 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock kind of thing in the daytime. We'll be covering it here on WGN Radio, and you can find all of the information at WGNradio.com. Patty is out there tonight. She's and I believe that unless she's coming back, she'll also be doing it tomorrow night. Well, with the death of Justice Scalia, the political fighting has been pretty much centered around the confirmation process, whether or not the president will be able to get a nomination through the Republican-controlled Senate. But even before that happens, there are a few cases that could be affected by the lack of nine justices. We've heard a little about the California case surrounding union dues. But what about the most recent news about the Clean Power Plan? The Supreme Court had ruled a stay to evaluate litigation from coal companies. There was also worry that the court would rule against President Obama's big clean power plan, sending us back to the drawing board when it comes to plan to curb pollution and take on climate change, which is really all of this came out of the Paris summit back in late 2015. So what does it mean? What does Justice Scalia's death mean for this particular case? Howard Lerner is the executive director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center based here in Chicago and a frequent guest here on the download. Good to see you, Howard.
Good to join you.
So let's talk about this because, you know, I was surprised, you know, I quickly got on the horn with you when I saw this news last week, but I was surprised to see that the Supreme Court issued a stay. That's not that usual, right?
This was extraordinary. Attorneys can't remember the last time that the Supreme Court has stayed a regulation under these circumstances from taking effect while the case is pending. As a practical matter, the Clean Power Plan doesn't require real reductions in pollution for another half dozen years. States are engaged in a planning process. The planning process will lead to plans that get finalized mm-hmm. in 2 to 3 years. At that point, there are several years before actual actions have to be taken. Most people viewed the request by some of the coal companies and some of the states as being, if you will, a Hail Mary pass. And generally speaking, experienced attorneys were stunned that the court, by a 5-4 decision, issued a very short, less than one-page order staying the Clean Power Act.
What was in that order?
All that order said was it stayed while the case is appealed before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. That's the second highest court in the land. That court has taken the case. It denied a stay. It set up an expedited briefing schedule. The case will have oral argument the beginning of June, and we would expect that sometime in the fall, maybe the early fall, the court will issue its opinion. If it upholds the Clean Power Plan, and we think more likely than not that's what will happen, then the coal companies in some of the states like West Virginia will file a petition for certiorari asking the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case.
And based on the stay, it seems like they're interested and it's almost like hinting that they want it.
Pretty clear from the stay that the Supreme Court will take the case. And indeed, it's probably a case the court ought to take. You know, there's certain cases that are just big, important cases for our country. Whether it's Obamacare, whichever side you happen to be on that, the same-sex marriage cases, or here the big climate change case, people sort of expect the Supreme Court will weigh in on that. So I think everybody on both sides think it's pretty likely the Supreme Court will consider the case on the merits, but a lot of people were stunned or very surprised by the really extraordinary stay action. But all that then gets turned upside down.
Right. We'll get
a
to
few
that
days
we're,
later.
We're going to get to
as
this.
Justice
yeah.
Scalia
but
passes
before,
away.
Before
sadly,
we talk about what the repercussions are or the ramifications of Justice Scalia's death. I'm interested because the people who are paying attention to this, who see that the Clean Power Plan comes out, and they say, you know, just laymen who are like, great, it looks like the USA is going to take climate change seriously. We're going to, you know, sort of look at reducing pollutions, carbon footprint, all that kind of stuff we've been talking about. It seemed like everybody on the surface was like in agreement that this was a good thing. Why? I mean, you said it is good for the case for the court to look at this, but why? I mean, it's not like it's that contentious or that controversial.
Well, it's pretty controversial, but you look at how the parties line up, and it's different than usual. So here in Illinois, a lot of people see the Clean Power Plan as both a way in which we're going to reduce pollution that improves public health. We step up and lead to do that. It's good for the environment. And it's an opportunity to help grow the clean energy sector. And that's good for jobs.
Sure.
That's good for economic growth. That's good for the environment. Illinois is the fifth largest state in the country in terms of wind power capacity. We have 13 major wind power companies with corporate headquarters in Chicago and about 20,000 jobs in the state through the solar and wind industry. So getting the clean power plan to drive clean energy jobs in Illinois, that's good for jobs, it's good for economic growth, it's good for the environment. It's a winner for this state. And not only are the environmental and public health groups supportive, so is the city of Chicago, so is Exelon. Exelon owns a lot of nuclear power plants.
Sure.
Exelon's nuclear plants compete with coal plants.
So it's the coal industry that obviously...
That's right.
They just understand that they're going to be forced into having to roll back, and also and that means at the end of the day lose money. But that's part of what we're figuring out as a society, isn't it? I mean, like, we can't keep producing at this rate with carbon and coal. It has to be reduced. The government comes in and says we all agree it needs to be reduced based on a summit in Paris. Mm-hmm. And here we are with the Supreme Court saying, not so fast. What are they going to say? No, and then we're going to go back and we're just going to spend years doing this back and forth?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, working to solve climate change problems is not a want to do. It's a got to do.
Right.
We are seeing the impacts in terms of extreme weather events, flooding, hurricanes, impact on people and on our weather that's predictable. And that's what the scientists are telling us is going to happen. So this is not a matter of we can say, you know, golly gee whiz, it'd be nice to do something about this. We got to do something. We need to lead here in Chicago, in the United States, and we need to step up and act globally. Whether carbon pollution comes from Indiana or Indonesia, same impact of heat-treating gases on the atmosphere. So this is one we've got to do. The trick is, how do we do it in a way that's both economically efficient, and it helps grow our economy? And doing that by growing energy efficiency that saves business and people money on our utility bills, growing the clean energy sector, wind power jobs, solar. I mean, these are ways in which we can grow the economy mm-hmm. that helps us here solve a problem. And the technologies that we develop, we deploy here, can be transferred to developing countries to help save the world in those countries and solve problems. So that's the opportunity.
Yeah, right. That's the opportunity. And that sounds common sense. So,
now,
you know,
if,
let's have judges.
If you own a lot of coal plants,
right.
What the Clean Power Plan does, it makes you internalize the economic costs of your pollution. You can't force the costs off on the public. It, in effect, prices your carbon pollution. So the coal companies and some states that have a lot of coal industry in there are suing the government, and they're saying this plan is no good. They're entitled to have their day in court.
Okay.
That's what they have before the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals is going to hear their case, and we hope they'll uphold the EPA. What the Supreme Court did, which was extraordinary, with all due respect, wrong, was by a 5-4 decision put a stay on the Clean Power Plan while the appeal was pending. And that's a political decision. The court's never done that sort of decision before. Mm-hmm. With all due respect, it wasn't the right thing for the court to do.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. And then we have to talk about replacing Justice Scalia and sure. what the vacancy means for this. I mean, this is,
right.
It was 5-4. You keep saying 5-4. Scalia was in the majority. So let's see, how it kind of plays.
This shifts the balance, Justin.
Howard Lerner is the executive director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center based here in Chicago. When we come back, more with Howard here in The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest, Howard Lerner, is the executive director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center based here in Chicago. Talking about the Clean Power Plan, the stay that was... that was put up by the Supreme Court last week. I mean, it was not even 7 days ago. And how that changes with the passing of Justice Scalia, who was in the majority of the stay and was obviously a vote against the Clean Power Plan if it was going to get to the Supreme Court. Howard, you wrote about this this week for your blog at the ELPC. Tell me about what could happen now that Justice Scalia is no longer on the court?
Well, a court has 9 votes. You count the votes. In the 2 preceding cases, Massachusetts versus EPA and AEP versus Connecticut, there were at least 5 justices who upheld the U.S. EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. That's pretty settled law. That's why the 5-4 vote on the stay really surprised people, particularly because Justice Kennedy swung over to be the 5th vote. But now one of those votes, sadly, is gone. So it's now 4-4, if you will. And on the merits, if Kennedy were to be with the justices he joined on Mass versus EPA, it's 5.
Right, 5-3.
All right, so 4-4, maybe 5-3 in favor of the Clean Power Plan. And the president now is moving to appoint a replacement for Justice Scalia. Now, as we all read in the newspapers and hear publicly, first Senator McConnell said, even though the president constitutionally has the right to appoint a justice, we're not going to let him go forward with an appointment. We won't consider one because he only has 340 days left in his term of office. With all due respect, the Supreme Court appointment is not in the Constitution, and the president appoints up until 340 days in advance.
Yeah, right.
The president is elected. He has the right to appoint somebody. The typical appointment process runs about 70 days in the Senate, so there's plenty of time. What we expect will happen is the president will nominate somebody, as he said, in due time, and there'll be tremendous pressure on the Senate and on the Republicans in the Senate to not be labeled obstructionist and to take up somebody on the merits. And the question then is, does the person have the intellectual capacity to be on the court? Is the person perceived as tough but fair? And is the person, to some degree, within the relative mainstream of American legal thought?
Let me ask you this, Howard. I feel like, you know, we've seen such a shift in the Supreme Court, just the values and the ideals of a Supreme Court justice over the years, where an issue like climate change is one that any justice that would be, any judge, anyone who would be up for the nomination of justice would look at this issue differently than a judge that maybe came up in the 70s or came up in the 80s. If a new judge comes in, regardless of their politics, don't they have a little bit more understanding of what our environmental issues are at this point, and would, beyond the fact of being conservative or liberal, would say, hey, this is something we got to get done?
Look, indeed, it's a pretty conservative principle to say scientists tell us that climate change is happening. It has a tremendous impact on extreme weather events, changing water levels, the way people live, and we're going to do the conservative, prudent thing about taking steps to try to avoid that problem. It's basically risk insurance, and I've never thought of home insurance or auto insurance as being conservative.
Right.
Or liberal.
Right.
It's what prudent people and thoughtful people do to protect against things that happen. It's the reason you go to a doctor and say, check me up and make sure that there's nothing wrong with me.
Right.
You hope there isn't, but you do that because that's a good, prudent, conservative thing to do. Judges read the newspaper, and I think that to some degree the justices on the court are certainly aware of how science has developed and changed, and what started off with 80% certainty went to 90, went to 95, and now 99% of the scientists agree what causes climate change. It's, you know, heated gases coming from power plants and from the transportation sector that get into the atmosphere and warm it up, increase the temperature, and that helps melt the polar ice cap and have other effects on water and the environment. So look at what happened on same-sex marriage. You know, 30 years ago, the Supreme Court, in a case in Georgia, Bowers versus Hardwick, denied that there was a right, or to be more precise, they refused to overturn a law in Georgia that made criminal behavior between same-sex couples. Then in a case called Lawrence versus Texas, the Supreme Court went the other way. And it's not necessarily because the court became more liberal or the court became so much different, the membership.
Times changed.
Times changed.
Right.
And You know, justices are people. They look at their friends, their family, society, and others. And in Lawrence versus Texas, the court said, you know what? Maybe we didn't quite understand it all right in the Georgia case 20-some years ago. And then recently, by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court, as we all know, in June, in effect, yeah, said that state laws legalizing same-sex marriage are permissible.
Let me ask you this, Howard, from talking about climate change.
Constitutionally, if you will, required.
Yeah. I guess the issue for me is, are there any precedents that are out there right now when it comes to regulating emissions, coal or you know, that could get in the way of moving forward on any government, any president, any administration trying to execute climate change or pollution reduction?
Sure they are, but within limits. Okay. The U.S. Supreme Court, without making this sound like my law school class...
I teach over at Northwestern.
Yeah. We go through this.
Yeah, I never have gone to law school.
In 2007, in the Massachusetts versus EPA case, what the Supreme Court said was that Congress in the Clean Air Act required EPA to regulate pollutants, which include carbon dioxide. Yeah. And therefore, if the EPA found that carbon dioxide endangered the public health based on science, which the EPA did, it had to regulate greenhouse gases to reduce that pollution. And then in a case called American Electric Power versus Connecticut in 2009, the court once again, this time with Chief Justice Roberts joining the majority, 6 votes, in effect reaffirmed Massachusetts versus EPA. So solid authority, twice the court has ruled that EPA can and must regulate carbon dioxide pollution, greenhouse gases that come from coal plants that affect the atmosphere that cause climate change and global warming.
I see.
Okay. The question then is not did EPA have authority. Most of the justices have so concluded, and even those who disagree are bound by what's called stare decisis, namely the courts decided the issue. The question is whether the EPA acted in a way that is arbitrary and capricious and exceeded its legal authority. All right. That's a fair argument for opponents to make, if they make it in those terms. And they also have a pretty heavy burden. To say that an agency is arbitrary and capricious means you have to overcome your burden where the agency is entitled to what's called deference to implement its statutory authority. So, is it possible they could win? They could argue, and there is some case law on this, that the agency just went well outside the bounds of its discretion to try to do the very best job it could do regulating greenhouse gases. But the agency has a lot of discretion, and that's whether it's the EPA or the Federal Communications Commission or the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, or any of the alphabet soup agencies. The fact is they're given discretion and some degree of deference, because otherwise everybody would go into court and just nitpick them death and sort of say, well, if I was head of the agency, here's what I would have done.
How do you even?
But that's not the standard. The standard is, did they act arbitrarily and capriciously, which most lawyers would sort of say, did they really screw up?
Right. Which in this case, no, because
we
don't know yet. But I say this a lot about a lot of things we talk about on the show, but fascinating.
You're welcome.
Fascinating. Let's see what happens. And we should come back. And I mean, you're on regularly, so we'll talk about some other things. But I definitely want to talk in June when the arguments are in front of the appeals court in D.C. about this, because this is the future of our planet. And the U.S. has to take a lead on it, and we're going to decide through the courts here coming up this summer into the fall. Howard Lerner is the executive director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center based here in Chicago. Howard, thanks for being here.
Good to join you, and I'll talk to you soon.
More to come here on The Download. It's fine arts night, Pete. It's going to be great. Rob, did you see we got classical music, we got opera, we have performance art, we have abstract art from the 50s. All the stuff that I know you love.
We're elevating. I'm elevating.
Pete and I were kind of tossing around the idea of maybe doing an hour a week. Like we could maybe there's so much great culture in town. We can give it like a cool, double entendre kind of name.
No, I agree.
Fine, fine, Fine art. I can figure that out. But we got a lot.
Well, see, now that's a work in progress.
That's a work in progress. Yeah. Ooh, work in progress.
Oh, there we go. Look at that. I just stumbled upon it.
Stumbled upon it. Well, that would be good. I mean, there's so much stuff. Like, I just got was talking with the Joffrey Ballet. They've got some great stuff coming up here in the spring. And I realize I've never talked to the Joffrey Ballet people at all. And I'm totally interested in that. Right? I don't know anything about ballet. Mm-hmm. But I feel like, you know, there's plenty of time left for me to learn.
Yeah.
It's been ages, but I love the CSO. I mean,
right.
It's just, they're fantastic.
And they're currently, I think it's current because they said it was February, they're touring Japan and the Far East. Like, they're all, like, the CSO is going from symphony house to symphony house in Japan and maybe Korea or China. But the point being that they're right now, like, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra is world renowned.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, so that I had talked to them about, you know, would they be able to call in from, like, you know, wherever they're, whatever stop they're at. Almost like, it's like a, well, like we do with Sam Panjanovic. Where are we at with the score? It's third quarter over there in the CSO show in Tokyo. So we'll... Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, it's been about 3 years since DuPage County leaders created a call to action over heroin use. Heroin deaths in the western suburbs were hitting epidemic levels. So now it's 2016. Did that call to action help? Have we seen declines? Just this year, the heroin crisis bill became state law. This law mandates that any policeman, firefighter, or school nurse have to be trained in and possess Narcan. Narcan, of course, is the drug used to treat heroin overdoses. Just this month, DuPage County officials registered their 100th save using the drug. My next guest is Dr. Richard Jorgensen. He's the DuPage County Coroner. Dr. Jorgensen, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate you talking about this important issue.
Let's talk about 2013. I mean, like I said, it's almost been 3 years, but what prompted you to have a call to action over heroin in DuPage County?
Well, in 2013, we had a marked increase in the number of deaths related to drug overdoses, especially heroin. And especially in the month of July in 2013, starting on the 4th of July weekend, we had 18 deaths in a row,
wow.
One death every day, 11 of which were due to heroin. And that caused many of us to realize that DuPage County had changed and we needed to address this issue.
Yeah, for you as a coroner, I mean, it's not the police, it's not the politicians. I mean, to be the coroner and be in that situation where you're seeing so many different bodies come through and having to do autopsies about heroin, what was going through your mind back in 2013?
Well, it was a shock. I had just been elected coroner, so I'd only been in office for 6 months or so. And it just was one of those things that I had not personally realized that this was such a bad problem. And then, again, to have a body come in every day for a month was shocking. So it just was something that, even as a physician, I had not been aware of how difficult and how widespread this problem was.
Well, you know, what you guys did in DuPage County was not unprecedented, but it was definitely progressive in the way that you called out that you called to action. We need to do something. We need to find a way to deal with this problem in the county, in the western suburbs. Now in 2016, talk about the last 3 years. I just kind of mentioned at the top. Have we seen declines?
Well, yes and no. To build on what you had commented on, we decided to develop a program where we were going to have the antidote for heroin more readily available. And we have had a very successful program implementing that. And then we did see declines. We saw a decline in 2014, but unfortunately in 2015, there's a new additive that's being used in these drugs called fentanyl. And you might have seen that in late September, October in Chicago, there was a huge overdose problem for about a week and a half. And that was due to fentanyl being added to the heroin. And at the end of 2015, we saw that more and more in our toxicology tests, that this fentanyl is being added to the heroin and making it much worse.
Well, let's talk about what you and other officials have really tried to do in the last 3 years, and that's the DuPage Narcan program. Talk about the program and how it's operating.
We, with the DuPage County Chief of Police Association, worked to develop a program that actually, very proud of our government. Government's always getting bad raps, but our leaders decided to work together. So we had the health department, the sheriff's office, the police, everybody working together to develop a program where we bought and outfitted every police officer in DuPage County with Narcan, which is the antidote for opiate overdoses. We trained them. We developed a program. Then we trained them. Then we outfitted them. During this time, it only took us 3 months to get the program going with state approvals and everything. By 6 months, we were training people, and by 1 year from even thinking of the idea, we had every police officer trained. In the first year, we only had half of the program implemented. We saved 31 lives. In the next year, 2015, we saved 61 lives. And then just 2 weeks ago, we just passed our 100th save, and we're now up to 105 saves in this program.
That's great. So, and it's surprising to me because it does have a little bit of a, I guess, a political center or political issue to get everybody together to have this drug be available for law enforcement to administer. There have been some politicians on record. I was just reading an article, a national article, about they don't like Narcan because that says that, you know, maybe gives the idea that the heroin user has an excuse or they don't have to worry about it because officers will have the antidote on them. How do you respond to that?
Two things. You did mention about whether this is political or not. I'm very, very proud to say that this has not been political in Illinois. You mentioned HB1, which was Representative Leader Lou Lang's bill, and that passed through the House and the Senate unanimously. I'm a Republican, and Lou Lang is a Democrat, but I went and testified and worked tirelessly for this bill. So this is not a partisan issue. This is a social issue. And to the second point as to whether you save somebody's life that's a addict, we all know, every person I believe that's listening knows somebody who is either currently addicted and ruining their lives or somebody who's been through rehabilitation, whether it's alcohol or drugs, and is now back to being a productive citizen. So we know that addicts under addiction have no control over their lives. They are under the control of the addiction. They need to have help. They need to be treated. And they can become productive citizens again. So to let a person die because they're addicted to something does not lead to the hope of that person becoming rehabilitated and becoming a productive citizen again. So that's my answer to that.
And secondly, we're talking about primarily what you're seeing is this affecting young adults.
Yeah, and I've looked at the entire demographics of all of our saves in DuPage County, and 75% of them are under 30, and 10% of them are under 19 years old. So of all of the people that were saved in this, 75% of the people are in their youth and then, you know, barely into their adulthood or even not into their adulthood. So we're talking about saving somebody's life who could have 40 or 50 years of productive life if we can get them into rehab.
Now, the health department, I mean, and this is also, you know, always tricky when it comes to municipal government. But the idea of, I mean, it's one thing to have Narcan on a police officer and he saves or, you know, saves someone who's overdosing from heroin. But it's another to then administer or to not necessarily, I don't know if responsible is the right word, but to help that person find treatment, to continue with rehabilitation. And DuPage County is doing that.
Correct. If you don't die, everyone has the right of privacy and HIPAA rights, which is the right that allows you to keep your medical record between you and your physician. So if a person lives, they have the absolute right to their personal privacy and to go home and that type of thing. Well, we've started to develop a program where anytime that a person is saved by using Narcan or that type of thing, that the health department has developed a crisis program that where we will try to get in touch with that person, either through the emergency room doctor, their family, some way to reach out to them and say, we can help you get into rehabilitation. So that we're just not saving their life and then letting them go back into drug addiction. We're trying to turn their lives around. And that's pretty unique.
Yeah, it is unique, especially for our government. But let me ask you this as we wrap up. Narcan is a drug that, I mean, like you said, Illinois has been great in the way that DuPage County has been able to have law enforcement officials have Narcan on their person when they're out in and about. But it's also it is highly politicized for the reasons we talked about earlier. Do you ever envision a world where Narcan can be an over-the-counter drug that people can purchase and have in their homes if they choose to do so?
Yes, I believe that will be the case, hopefully very soon. I'm a physician. I can tell you that Narcan has virtually no side effects. You know, every drug has something, but it's very, very low in its complications, allergies, side effects. It's very, very minimal. There are many drugs that are over the counter that are much more potential for danger to a person. So I would hope that this would become a non-prescription drug. The idea behind why do we have a prescription drug is because it's either dangerous or it's addictive or it's a problem. So none of those things are in this case. This is a drug that can only save someone's life, and many people believe that it should be more readily available rather than less readily available.
DuPage County Coroner Dr. Richard Jorgensen talking about the 100th save using the drug Narcan and DuPage County officials, actually 105 now. Dr. Jorgensen, thanks for joining us tonight.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Very excited to bring in my next guest, Peter Taub. We're going to talk about the MCA show that's coming up here, Speak Bitterness. But also, 8th Blackbird, the artist in residency, won a Grammy last night, which is great. Did you watch the Grammys, Rob?
I got bits and pieces. I was intrigued by what happened to Adele. And then, of course, you had Taylor Swift's speech taking a little jab at Kanye. So
I like the Taylor Swift, I'm a shortstop for the Toronto Blue Jays handshake when she won with her friend there. She like did the slap, slap, up, down. But it was like extremely choreographed.
Sure.
And slow.
I'm so surprised. Here, let's do our handshake.
It's like, you know, whenever I see a football player or baseball, usually like when he hits a home run and then they do an awesome hand signal thing for 15 seconds, I'm like, how eloquent. Then you see Taylor Swift here and you're like, how awkward.
Yeah. No, it always cracks me up too because guys on like a 1-16 team will be doing like the big elaborate handshake. Right. It's like, guys, you know, come on.
They got a lot of time. They're not practicing.
That's right.
That's their problem. Less hand coordinated choreography and more drills. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Well, last night, the contemporary music ensemble 8th Blackbird won their 4th Grammy. How about that, huh? Everyone's all, you know, all spotlight on Taylor Swift, but look at the ensemble 8th Blackbird, their 4th Grammy. Their Chicago-based sextet is the current artist in residence at the MCA Chicago. You can go to the museum and watch them rehearse. They actually recorded their record there that they won the Grammy for. The MCA artist in residency is just one of the performances you can go see at the museum. And according to most critics, the MCA Chicago continues to be a gem, presenting fascinating and compelling theater and stage work for about 20 years. And the man behind that stage for 20 years, Peter Taub. Taub is the director of performance programs at the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago. He's got next shows coming up called Speak Bitterness, a show where a group of performers confess to everything. 6-hour show, confess to everything. Sounds great. Peter Taub, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And do I say congratulations to you for the 8th Blackbird? I mean, it's kind of like that's your artist.
It's really exciting.
Right?
They're a gem, and I think they're recognized outside of Chicago more, perhaps, than they are here. And that's why they've chosen for this entire year to make all of their rehearsals public. They're rehearsing in the museum, and you can check the schedule, come by, chat with them, learn about what they're doing. And then along the way, there's lots of other discussions, workshops, and then, of course, concerts. And our next concert's coming up in late March.
When you talk about artists in residency, especially at the Museum of Contemporary Art, I don't think of an ensemble rehearsing as you know, sort of the like sort of the traditional fair. I mean, where do you come up with an idea where you say, okay, you know what's going to be an artist in residence? A band, and we're going to open up their space. And you, if you go, I just went on Sunday. You can see where their piano's at, and their all the equipment is set up. I mean, that you can really watch the band rehearse.
Yeah, I mean, I think the museum is in a sense pushing against the historical conventions of what museums have been. Instead of it being a place where you go to quietly contemplate finished, you know, works of beauty, instead it's a balance of that and an experience of things that are being made in process before us. And in that sense, the museum is very much part of the evolving shape of contemporary life, part of the evolving shape of contemporary culture. So it makes sense for us to have artists in residence who are, in fact, right there in our midst, where we, the audience, can interact with them.
It's a fascinating, I mean, go check it out. It's really cool. I think it's the second or third floor. It's really cool. Let's talk about the show coming up. And then we'll do that. Then we're going to take a break. And then I'm going to ask you about 20 years of doing this. It's amazing to think that I remember when you started, it was a big deal that you started here in Chicago, but I was looking back at some of the articles and I found a Tribune article dated to 1996. My old friend Accio Bejas, who was introducing you to Chicago. It's amazing to think. But let's talk, before we do that, let's talk about the next show, Speak Bitterness. I kind of set it up, and at the beginning I was like, okay, it's a show where performers get on stage and they confess.
Yeah, and it's in a sense, it's a kind of a competition to amongst themselves to confess to everything, to the entire catalog of all sins imaginable across the history of time. And some of them are modest or private, things like I looked in your diary, or I said I'd take the dogs out, but I didn't. And others are, you know, much grander. Corporate crimes, crimes against humanity, larceny, theft, things like this. And the setup is really very simple. It's six people, a long metal table, and they each take turns confessing. And it goes on and on and on over the course of 6 hours. And during that course of time, things that are serious become comical. Things that are comical become serious. And it's an incredible experience.
Talk about why you brought it in. I mean, what about this show and the people who were behind this show appealed to you?
Yeah, the group behind the show is called Forced Entertainment. They're from England, and they're probably the most influential experimental theater company in England. They've been working now for 30 years. And over time, they've made a huge range of different kinds of plays and performances, from things that are much more straightforward to things like this that are marathon events. And all of their marathon events play with this notion of time and how we experience time. They set out when they started in the mid-80s to make theater for a generation of people who had grown up with the television always on. And as such, they work to create theater that pushes against the conventions or the normal ideas of what theater is and how we experience
it. Well, I mean, right away, the idea that the audience can come and go, or you can just pop in for a second and leave, you can come back, is different than the traditional theater where you got to be in your seat and you got to have the door shut, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. The audience can come and go. You can stay for as long as you like. And I think over the course of that longer-term event in the theater, it also pushes away the notions of how you're supposed to experience theater. They're quite eager to encourage people to feel like they're part of an event, in fact. And for the people who aren't going to be able to come to the MCA either because they're not able to, because they're scheduled or they live elsewhere, we're going to be live streaming the entire performance.
And this is Saturday. It's a one-time show. This is one thing about a lot of shows at the MCA. It's just a weekend or it's one show and it's gone. This huge event or undertaking. But yeah, you're right. This is 6 hours on Saturday.
Right. 6 hours starting at 4 o'clock on Saturday. And the hashtag where people can even participate in a sense by adding their own confessions to a running stream of commentary. It's going to be FE for Forced Entertainment, Speak Live. So you can also find that at the MCA's website, mcachicago.org.
Talking with Peter Taub. He's the director of performance programs at the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago. It's coming up on 20 years. This is his 20th year at the MCA. Let's take a break. We'll come back and talk about your career here. I want to know about what makes you tick, but also, you know, what goes through your mind when you're bringing these theatrical experiences to Chicago audiences. It's a download. Stay with us. Is a selection from 8th Blackbird's Grammy-winning record, Filament, which they won the Grammy for Best Chamber Music Small Ensemble Performance. This is from Filament, which was recorded at the MCA. Let's take a listen. Blackbird, four Grammys in their career. The Contemporary Music Ensemble won last night at the Grammys. Their record Filament was recorded at the MCA Chicago. Peter Taub is the Director of Performance Programs at the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago. 8th Blackbird, artist in residence at the museum. Peter, as I mentioned before the break, you know, we were talking about the shows that come to the Museum of Contemporary Art on stage, their beautiful stage. It's been 20 years. I mean, take us back to 1996. Why did you take this job?
It was a brand new theater in a beautiful new building, and the program had yet to be developed. But I knew that the basic core of the MCA is really vital, and from its inception had always integrated live arts, the living body, the performing body, into the rest of the visual artwork that it was pursuing, that it was tracking. And the MCA really sees itself as you know, being part of contemporary culture, not just a place that you go to look at contemporary culture, but really being part of contemporary culture. And the culture that we live in is multifaceted. We live in a world where there is music and movement and art and
is there
know,
was there
writing.
Any pushback? I don't know where the pushback would come from, and the artists or the audience or possibly people inside the building about sort of categorizing that art is priority. It's a museum of contemporary art, and the stage work will be complimentary. It'll be on the side. Was there any pushback to the idea of the stage being such a presence at the MCA?
No, I think we really try to make it one organization and to integrate across all of the different platforms. And so our director, Madeline Grinstein, and our chief curator, Michael Darling, and I and others really work together to create an integrated program. And sometimes things are, you know, specifically integrated, like this past summer and fall, there was a fantastic project called Freedom Principle that looked at experimental black art and music. And so both in the exhibition galleries and on the stage, there were a lot of interrelated programs. And other times you have something like 8th Blackbird, this music group that's actually occupying one of the galleries for an entire year and doing programs on the stage. So we really looked for opportunities to cross those platforms and to show how much of an interrelated world that we live in.
Let me ask you this. I mean, because you've been lauded for being focused on the local, which is great. I mean, to local performances, local artists, 8th Blackbird being one of them, Chicago Six Deck. But you also do a tremendous amount of work internationally. You know, the group that's coming in on Saturday is an experimental group from London. You just had in artists, I believe it was from Japan. That was the baseball piece.
God bless baseball.
Yeah, right. But talk about the balance that you have to go through to make sure that Chicago is represented when it comes to contemporary work on stage, mm-hmm. and also to bring international flair and art to Chicagoans.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think that sense of balance is one of those ongoing quests, really. But for instance, the group from England, they're from Sheffield, England, which is a little bit of a second city too. It's a gritty industrial city. They're forced entertainment. And rather than just bringing them for the one show, Speak Bitterness, we're bringing them for four different projects over the course of 2 weeks. And so we get to have a kind of deep dive. And because they are so influential internationally and have made such a difference in the world of experimental theater, and Chicago is such a strong theater town, we thought it would be great to have those multiple opportunities for people to experience their work. So in addition to that marathon event on Saturday, Speak Bitterness, we've got a play called The Notebook, which is a two-person play about twin boys. Then we've got a project that's actually at the Chicago Cultural Center that's called Institute of Failure. It's a project in which Chicago writers have written short essays to be performed by the members of Forced Entertainment. And that whole thing is put together by their artistic director, Tim Etchells from Forced Entertainment, and one of Chicago's really original writers, Matthew Gulish. And then the following weekend, the 25th, 26th, 27th of February, we're doing a project called Incomplete Works Tabletop Shakespeare. We're co-presenting it with Chicago Shakespeare Theater, and it's abridged versions of 12 different Shakespeare plays, four a night for 3 nights, each acted out with tabletop on a tabletop with household objects like salt and pepper shaker, ketchup bottle, vinegar bottle, things like this. And those are the characters, and individual members of the Forced Entertainment Ensemble tell each of those plays.
Is there anything that in your mind, Peter Taub, where you're like, come on, that's absurd? Is there a moment where you're like, all right, salt and pepper shakers doing Shakespeare, okay, that's even me. Come on, guys.
Yeah, and I think that's what's great about Forced Entertainment is that they take a very simple idea, totally original, and somehow make it work. And they play with that border of, you know, is this theater? Is this storytelling? Is this, you know, comedy? And they just draw us in that very original way.
You've made so many great shows have come through the MCA, but one of the things that it seems like you've really claimed or put a stake in the ground is that idea of pushing the boundaries of what theater is. I mean, I think of I forgot the name of it, but the reading of Great Gatsby, mm-hmm. that was the huge play.
Yeah, Elevator Repair
yes,
Service.
Yes. Yeah. But that is a great, I mean, that was a huge hit in New York that started here at the MCA.
Right.
But those kind of shows where they're longer than maybe an audience may be particularly familiar with, it pushes a little bit further than what maybe they know to be theater. I mean, is that fair of assessment of how you evaluate talent and shows that come through?
Yeah, we're really looking to artists to see what they're doing. And we, not everything we do is long in any way. We just had a show this past weekend that was, you know, just over an hour, and it was a
tremendous... Should blow everybody's mind into a two-minute show. All right, thank you. Sit down. Okay, you can leave.
No, I think sometimes it's just a matter of finding things that are transformative, things that make a difference, that have something important to say, something that resonates with us in our daily lives. We're looking for, you know, original voices and, you know, innovative expressions, but people who have something to say that relates to us.
How do you think the Chicago audience has been to the MCA? When I flip it, and I mean, it's obviously you have a good subscription sort of people come out to the MCA. But, you know, getting past just the people who may already be in line with what the MCA is doing. How have you been with audiences that may just be standard theater goers or aren't used to contemporary art?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that we do is co-present programs throughout the year. Maybe about 25 or 30% of the programs that we do are partnership programs with community partners. And some of them are sort of large annual things, like we have an annual program that we do with Chicago Humanities Festival, or coming up right in early March is a program called Winning Works with three new works of dance with Joffrey. Other things that bring in audiences are the specific topic or the specific artist for each thing. So some, maybe a dance project, a theater art project, a music project. But it's really a matter of inviting people who want to be adventurous and experience something new, something different in a beautiful setting.
Let me ask you a tough question, just to end it. You know, our 20 years, which is great. Is there a time where you're just like enough contemporary art? Like I've done everything I can do. I need to move on. I mean, we're looking forward into the future. Where do you see yourself?
I think the terrain is shifting so dramatically, and it's really broad, and it's really exciting. So the platform of the MCA gives me, and I think by extension our broader cultural community, amazing opportunities to see things that people are making. And when I see what's being done here, as well as when I see what's being done around the country and across the Europe and Asia and South America, it's really very exciting. We have an ongoing series that focuses on contemporary theater from Latin America. South America right now happens to be particularly fertile ground for new theater. And a lot of the people who are making the biggest difference are people in their 30s and 40s who came of age as their governments changed from military rule to democratically elected states. And so the things that they're expressing are just so vital. And so for me, it's continuing to be exciting.
That's good to hear. Because if you would have answered that, I got to get out of this. I would have been it. I would have been upset. I would have been upset. The show Speak Bitterness is this Saturday, 4 o'clock at the MCA. Right there. What's the address of the MCA?
It's 220 East Chicago.
Right.
Chicago Avenue, Chicago. One block east of Michigan.
That's right. Peter Taub is the Director of Performance Programs at the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago. Peter, thanks for coming in and talking tonight.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
That was great. That was a good start to the Fine Arts 90 Minutes. That might not be the right name for it. I don't know, Rob.
I don't know. I'm still working on it.
Fine Arts 90 Minutes coming up next. Esmeralda, I don't know if you have been listening at all, because we're thinking about branding a Fine Arts Hour. We need a cool name. It's got to be like a hip, cool name.
For, you know, Fine Arts.
Yeah. It's got to be like a play off of Fine Arts.
Ugh.
So we're
good luck.
The highbrow.
What'd you say, the highbrow?
The highbrow.
Oh, that's not bad either with the eye. Yeah, like, can we do like an eyebrow thing and make it really cool?
Something like that.
Yeah. We're getting somewhere. The highbrow. And then we can make it like a picture of an eyebrow, but it's actually 200 pictures of different parts of the eyebrow.
And would you have an eye?
One eye, and you can barely see the. And the eye is actually a mosaic. It's a quilt.
Wait, or a monocle?
Or 600 different. I don't know. I'm really into contemporary art right now. I know you guys can tell I'm trying to come up with those things. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, a new exhibit opens up at the University of Chicago Smart Museum of Art. It's called Monster Roster, Existentialist Art in Post-War Chicago. The exhibit focuses on the work of the Monster Roster Ensemble, a group of post-war artists who are credited with developing the first uniquely Chicago style of art. Well, what does that mean? John Corbett is the co-curator of the exhibit, and he's also the owner of the gallery Corbett vs. Dempsey in Wicker Park, Ukrainian Village, and he's my guest tonight. John, good to see you.
Pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about this. I say in the intro, I say ensemble, right? But the Monster Roster, it wasn't as much an ensemble as it was just a group of artists sort of in the same theme.
That's true, yeah. They were really not working as a collective in any way. They were sort of a group of artists who were all friends. They all knew one another. They were working together at the same time, which is right after the war, 48 to 69 is what the show covers. And they were named by actually one of the members, or one of the people who was associated with the group, was also a writer, was a journalist named Franz Schultz. And in 1959, he called them the Monster Roster, gave them a kind of indelible moniker.
What makes them special and worthy of an exhibit at the Smart Museum?
Well, first of all, from a Chicago standpoint, they really represent the first time that we can say a group of artists were doing something that was not in really any way derived from any place else. So they were doing something uniquely their own, uniquely Chicagoan. They were continuing at a time when abstract art was extremely dominant. They were continuing a figurative tradition. Almost all the work in the show and most of the work that they were making was really the figure in one way or another, so images of people. But then in a broader sense, one of the things that we're really interested in is putting it out so people can look at it and see how great it is on its own merits in relation to anything else that you could go see from that time.
I know the name Monster Roster, and I know the particular, I don't want to say the style of art, but I knew there was legacy to it. What should we know about them? Because it seems, were they heralded as great artists or artists at the time? I mean, tell us a little bit more about what was happening at the time when the Monster Roster, quote-unquote, collective was working.
You know, in American art at that time, really the big rage was abstract expressionism, and that was a group of artists based in New York. We know Jackson Pollock, we know Willem de Kooning, we know Mark Rothko, people like that. And it was a group of artists who also had the support of a range of critics who were really on their side.
Right? East Coast critics, probably New York Times, things like that.
Very strong ties to people who, and they seem to have somebody following around all the time with a camera. So they're well documented. Not so much here. We didn't have the commercial infrastructure. The gallery infrastructure was not as well developed as it was there. The museum infrastructure was fantastic, but just wasn't paying quite the same attention.
Yeah, they weren't focusing on local artists. The Art Institute was focusing on the international work.
Yeah, and wasn't quite as trained at that moment on the contemporary scene, the way that some of the New York museums were charged with being right on top of things that were coming out. So you had a different context here, and so some of the artists did go on to garner international reputations. Leon Golub, who's really sort of the kingpin of the Monster Roster, went on to be internationally known. But then there were also artists who had local reputations, people who taught here. Ted Halkin is a great example, taught here for 50 years at the School of the Art Institute. And so there was both a kind of local, regional, and international sense. Some of them were well known around the world, and some of them were not known at all.
Well, what was the, I mean, speaking locally, I think of that time, and I know, like, right in the mid-50s, you had sort of the explosion of, I guess, the comedy scene here. Second City is talked about at that time. What was the art scene like in the 50s in Chicago? Was it dominated by a certain type of artist? Where did Monster Roster fit in?
Oh, that's a great question. There were competing worlds, and the dominance, you know, nationwide of abstraction at that time meant also that there were great abstract painters in Chicago. You have to remember, this is a place with a lot of art teaching, a lot of art activity going on, even in that period. It's one of the most important art centers in the country. So there were lots of different things going on. But one of the things was this continuation of a figurative tradition. I mean, you had counter tendencies. You had the abstract painters. You also had the existence of the new Bauhaus, which had moved here in the late 1930s. And so you had, with that, you had this, what's called, you know, the international style of abstraction. You had also an interest in design there. What's really interesting is that all of that was going on simultaneously. And somebody like Leon Golub, who had his own very strong personality as an artist, I mean, the work was rough, sometimes really nasty, looking at the darker or the deeper parts of the human psyche. But he was also a really great supporter of the underdog, always.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was later in paintings that he made that featured scenes of torture and advocacy for people who were the underdog, or whether it was in his hometown when he was a junior in college at the School of the Art Institute and was fighting for the rights of people who didn't have opportunities to show. So he actually came up with something called Exhibition Momentum, which was a really interesting moment in Chicago art. 1948, the School of the Art or the Art Institute of Chicago decided to not allow its students at all in. And that was under pressure from the teachers who were teaching at the School of the Art Institute, whose students were winning awards at the...
So they wanted the students out?
They didn't allow them into the show that they would normally right. be allowed into, called the Chicago and Vicinity Show.
Because they was a jealousy? Or was it the fact that they were taking spots? It was just a fear of losing out to the students?
Yeah, I mean, the students, as students are, were on top of the newest thing going on, and some of the older teachers were kind of fuddy-duddies.
Wow, yeah, right.
And so you ended up with them jealous of their students. And so what happened is they basically shut down the students. And Golub got really angry about that, not for himself, but in principle, that this was just a terrible idea. So he started a counter exhibition called Exhibition Momentum. And that into that, he allowed not only all of the people who would be in the monster roster, but people from all walks of the Chicago art scene.
It seems to me to almost echo or parallel the idea of what we see in the creative scenes of today, whether it be music. There's a mainstream music, and then there's an alternative or a place, a counterculture place. Same with theater, same with art. Does that kind of branch out from what Monster Roster did? And you mentioned, you know, talking about the underdog and talking about the idea of making sure you're inclusive to the underdogs of Chicago. Does that kind of stem from what that was happening in 1948?
I think you can make a case that what they put on the table was a do-it-yourself sensibility that has resonated for generations since them. And they're often compared, I think sometimes erroneously, to the group that came after them, which was a better-known group, ultimately the Chicago Imagists in the 1960s. They don't have a lot in common in terms of style, in terms of approach at all, but they do have one thing in common, which is that they took things into their own hands. And when people were not paying attention to them or when the opportunities weren't there, rather than sit there and complain about it, they actually took arms.
Sounds familiar.
Right.
It sounds like a lot of Chicago artists have done over the years and made their name. We're talking with John Corbett, who's the co-curator of the new show. It's called Monster Roster, Existentialist Art in Postwar Chicago. You know, what was it about this time in not just Chicago, but in the country that drew you to this work? I mean, this is something that, you know, obviously you put your heart and passion into. What is it about this time in American art that draws you, an artist yourself, to the mix?
We've spent 6 years working on this show itself, and we spent a long time really deep in our noses in the books and going and looking around at this work, partially just out of our own fascination with what was going on there. You have to also remember the historical context, right? You're coming out of the war.
Right.
It's a period where a lot of the innocence of the pre-war period has been shattered. And you're coming into a time when people have a sense that there's potential justification for being optimistic. But underneath that optimism, which is that there's going to be a rosy future, there's also the feeling that there's potential for basically the world to go south.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot, the age of anxiety is upon us. And so one has nuclear holocaust as a sort of regular theme. So the kinds of things that the Monster Roster artists were reading and arguing about amongst themselves make their way into the work. And the work transforms from being something that was this kind of romantic, not their work, but the work that was coming out of it, you know, during the WPA era in the late 30s and early 40s, has been transformed into something that is has come of age. And suddenly you're dealing with philosophical themes of that, you know, go back to classical times. You have a lot of Greek and Roman characters who appear in these paintings. You have, a lot of ghosts, a lot of demons mm-hmm. coming out. You have the Holocaust in the background, as a lot of these artists could specifically relate to those images because most of them were either Jewish or of recent immigrant families.
This art collective, I mean, and it's interesting too because the counterculture movement, the almost anti-war movement, kind of started in the 60s where you had, you know, the Vietnam War. But this group dispersed at that time. I mean, it was almost like when we know the counterculture movement of America and art and music and all the radical, almost hippie culture that came, this is when the art collect, the Monster Roster just dispersed. So talk about why.
Partially because they weren't really a group to begin with. I mean, they were individuals who had things in common, who were some of them were roommates, some of them were married to one another. There were all sorts of, you know, interconnections. But they weren't really a group to disperse in that sense. And what happened, which is a normal thing that's happened mm-hmm. over and over again, is you start as a group that has commonalities. And then as each of those individuals within that group grow and develop, they become more specialized and they sort of drift apart. And so in, you know, by 1969, which is when the last piece in the show was made, basically they were all doing something quite different from one another. And so it doesn't make sense at that point to talk about them as the Monster Roster anymore.
Right. For you, as you mentioned, 6 years of working on this, I mean, to see it come to fruition, to be at the Smart Museum, what does it mean for you? And as an artist, as someone who owns a gallery, what does it mean for you to see this finally presented to Chicago?
It's moving. I mean, I think it's going to be moving for people who really who come into it and stand in it. I mean, the second room in the show has two gigantic, and by gigantic, I mean 20-foot long or tall Leon Gala paintings. And to have been in the room while they were both being uncrated and hung was a breathtaking experience. And you were seeing they're both two singular figures derived from Roman friezes. And they're both going up in this room, and you just have this feeling that two titans are facing off in a way. And it's interesting, too, because one of them is owned by the Art Institute of Chicago, and one of them is owned by the MCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art. So you're seeing two titanic museums also represented there. So you've got all sorts of emotions and all sorts of interconnected things going on.
Chicago history, too, right?
It really is. It's an amazing thing.
It's running till June, so you got some time to see this. So the show's called Monster Roster, Existentialist Art in Postwar Chicago. It's at the Smart Museum down in Hyde Park. John Corbett's the co-curator. He also is the owner of the gallery, Corbett vs. Dempsey, which is in Wicker Park, Ukrainian Village. John, thanks for coming in and talking about it.
My pleasure.
More to come here on The Download. We're doing our Fine Arts Hour, highbrow. I like it. What do you think? I like it. That's a Martyr special. You don't like it?
It's all right. It's all right. I mean, let's continue to massage it a little bit and see where it goes.
Tonight on The Download, we strung together a couple of interviews that are really all focused on fine arts here in Chicago, arts and culture. So Rob and I are kind of trying to come up with a good name for the we do it like every Tuesday night. We could do highbrow every Tuesday night. I like highbrow.
I think if Pete were back on sugar again, he'd be able to get into this as well. I don't like the Pete not on sugar.
I know. He's just so morbid. He's so morose. It doesn't matter.
That's been a good show tonight, though. A lot of good guests.
It's very diverse in the way that, like, it's amazing to go from DuPage County heroin, fighting heroin overdoses to Monster Roster, the artists of the 1950s. But that's great. That's what we do here. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my guests tonight are some of Oberlin College's finest. The Music Conservatory is celebrating 150 years. A tour is underway, just came through Chicago. Marcy Stonikas is a opera singer who was at Oberlin in 2002 and grew up in Elmhurst, Illinois. And Daniel Hutzinger is a current student at Oberlin who plays piano and is also from Chicago, Jefferson Park area. Both of you, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Marcy, how does it feel to get back, you know, and give back to Oberlin now that you're out and you're on way with your opera career? What's it feel like to be back with your college?
It's really actually a special experience for me. I'm very nostalgic for Oberlin. I had a really great 4 years there, and was actually really honored to be part of the tour, in no small part due to the fact that I got to also come back to Chicago as part of that. So I'm honored to be a part of it, and I've also just been delighted by the caliber of the playing of the orchestra and having a great time.
What does it mean? I mean, for you, I mean, what did you, let's go back. I mean, what did you learn from being a part of at Oberlin, and what has it meant to you in your professional career?
I think I really kind of figured out what it meant to be a musician, really, like a complete musician at Oberlin. I always sang, and I did play instruments before I decided that singing was what I wanted to do.
What instruments?
I started really young at 5 playing piano, and then fortunately for my parents I stopped playing the piano. They stopped torturing them. But I replaced it with flute, and then I replaced that with bassoon. And so I trial and error, because I definitely made my parents' ears bleed.
When did you recognize that you were going to be a singer?
I always sang also. Mm-hmm. So that was always kind of part of the whole deal. Like, music always spoke to me. And I was always really drawn to many different forms of music. And I don't think you could get me to shut up, really. So I started singing jazz and musical theater first before I had even really any inclination towards classical singing. I went to CSO concerts all the time growing up. Like, in high school, I would come on the train to the city and go to a concert, but had never seen an opera. And actually saw my first opera on my audition weekend at Oberlin. And so that was kind of
stop right there.
Okay.
Audition weekend.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with that concept.
I know, yeah. It's an additional process that musicians and performing artists in general have to go through, in addition to just applying for a school. And it is an indication of kind of potential and also current level of talent.
So it's kind of the college interview.
Yeah, it is.
My college interview, they just said, well, what do you want to do? I want to do this. Okay, well, he's warm-blooded.
Precisely. Yeah, exactly. He's alive.
He's alive. But for you, there's an audition process if you want to go to Oberlin.
It is quite competitive at Oberlin in particular, because it's got a liberal arts school, but it's also a conservatory separate from the college. And at least when I was at Oberlin, the conservatory was only 500 students. So there's a lot more than 500 people in that, you know, that's in the entire mm-hmm. 4-year program. And there's a lot more than, you know, however, 150 people that are applying for those spots.
Let's bring Daniel Hutzinger. He's a junior?
I'm in my last year.
You're in your last year at Oberlin. Why did you choose to study piano and study music at Oberlin?
Oberlin, as Marcy said, has both a college and a conservatory. And they have this program called the double degree program, where you end up with both a Bachelor of Arts and a Bachelor of Music. So you're studying in the college, doing a liberal arts degree, and in the conservatory doing a music degree. So I study history in the college and piano in the conservatory. And I knew that I wanted to do music, but I also loved academics and didn't want to give that up. So Oberlin was ideal for that, because they're literally across the street from each other. Mm-hmm. There's no barriers. It's the same school. There are other schools that have similar programs, but they're usually different campuses. And so Oberlin was ideal because it's a really high-quality conservatory, but also a really high-quality liberal arts school, so that, you know, if I get bored of piano or just tired of piano, I can go do academic things.
Well, we just heard from Marcy talk about, you know, when she was 5 years old, she was already in music. Talk about your life. I mean, when did you sort of get into piano?
Yeah, so I started playing around first grade, which for pianists is sort of late.
Really?
And then, yeah, I mean,
isn't that sad?
Those kids start, like, violin and piano, you start, like, 3, 5. I don't know how, but
my 8-year-old's not going to be a pianist then.
Already missed the window. Yeah, and so I loved it always, but it was sort of, you know, like, one thing that I did. And then in high school, I started to get more into it and started to practice more. And I don't really know, like, a watershed moment when I was like, this is what I want to do. It sort of fell into it.
I'm interested in just the concept and the maturation of being a musician and deciding that that's going to be what you do for your life. Do you come from musical families? I mean, what was it that drew you to the idea that you were going to do this professionally or go study at Oberlin?
I come from a musical family in as much as my family loves music and they, you know, it's part of their lives. My parents met in college choir, but they don't do it for
a living.
Career. Yeah, it's like not their job exactly. Right. So I have no idea where I got that crazy cockamamie idea, but I felt like it was. I mean, to put it in better terms, I tried a bunch of other things. Like, I tried to be reasonable about it and be like, this is just not viable. What am I thinking about? And
you wanted to be an accountant.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that I didn't really want to be an accountant in my soul. But I was like, that's probably more legitimate, more stable, more, I don't know what, normal, quote unquote normal.
Right.
And it just ended up being like trying to ram a square peg into a round hole.
Well,
it just didn't work.
We had Mary Zimmerman, who's a theater director.
Yeah, I know her, actually. Yeah.
She was in here. We had a great conversation about at what point you choose to follow that craft and be a professional artist. And mm-hmm. We were talking about the old saying that everybody's an artist until they're told they're not.
Right.
I mean, there's a certain point. And for you guys, and this is what draws me to this conversation with you, is that you've made a choice to say, you know what, I'm not going to be an accountant.
Right.
I'm going to continue being an artist.
I mean, I think that it's one of those things that you do eventually have to put your foot down. And hopefully you are not alone and you have like some sort of support system set up so that you keep going and it's not just, you know, a personal mission. You know, other people that are saying, yes, this is the right path for mm-hmm. you, no matter how difficult it may seem or how impossible it may seem any given day. You got to do this.
Right.
And I was fortunate to have that.
Well, classical music, opera and of course, piano. I mean, it is a very difficult career path. On the one hand, it's hard to find jobs that are going to pay. But on the other end, the good news is there's probably not a billion people that are vying for those jobs. Maybe, you know, it's competitive. But Daniel, as you get ready to enter the quote unquote real world, what are you thinking about and what are you thinking about doing with your professional life?
So I'm sort of taking a kind of middle path where I actually want to go into like administrative stuff. So I know I want to keep music in my life and I want to keep performing. Like, so piano is a very solitary kind of pursuit. You spend a lot of time in a room alone. And I love that time. And honestly, that's when I feel like I make the best music, which is mm-hmm. unfortunate for sharing it with people. But so I know I love piano, but getting up in front of a stage, in front of an audience full of people is not always the best. So like, I know I want to keep it in my life. And doing like the administration route is to me sort of ideal because it lets me share this thing that I love and present it in a way maybe to people, as many people as possible. So basically, I want to be in a position where I can present this thing that I love to as many people as possible in as interesting a way as possible. Because I think with classical music, a lot of sort of the problems with getting it across to people is often more the way it's presented more mm-hmm. than anything else. Because it's this sort of like stultifying temple of music that's horrifyingly scary to people. And they play the same things all the time.
I know,
yeah,
right?
So
just this old junk.
Well, Marcy, let me ask you this. You know, as a Oberlin grad and someone who has been successful in opera, your resume is pretty deep for someone who's been doing this now. I mean, what, you've been doing it for...
Not a long time.
What do you say to Daniel? You know, the kid who's right here. I mean, this is... I mean, maybe you haven't had a chance to have that conversation yet. But,
yeah, no.
But what is it that you say to Daniel who's getting ready to go on the same route that you have?
I think that what he has just been talking about is really, really vitally important to keeping the performing arts, in particular classical music, thriving. Because I do think that we need really positive advocates who have really musical backgrounds and have really been in the depths and know what it takes to be a musician, but also know that it's not some unattainable, unrelatable art form. That it is something that kids can get into. It is something that watches hockey, that watches football, can mm-hmm. still appreciate. And I think that that's like one of those things that, you know, people think that classical music thinks of itself as a superior art form, and that maybe classical musicians think that of themselves as well. But that's, it couldn't be further from the truth. We're really down to earth normal people, at least on the whole, you know, by and large. And I try not to make sweeping statements. And so I think that someone who wants to be an advocate and wants to be an administrator because of the passion that he or she may possess, but know that they don't necessarily need to be a performer, are just as vital, or maybe more vital than someone who actually wants to be on the center, you know, in the center of the stage, getting all the attention.
For me, I think of one of the things that is always overlooked with musicians is discipline. I mean, the ability, you know, in piano, you think about all of the amount of time, and you talked about it being a solitary pursuit, but how much you have to put into learning the instrument, learning the craft, and training. It's hours upon hours. I was in New York City, and I had the great fortune of living next to or staying next to an opera singer.
Oh, yeah.
All they did was they warmed up at like
10
like for 4
yeah.
hours. Like, it was just like nonstop at the top of their lungs. And I was just like, oh, my, all right, enough of that. but what I took away from it and what I understood about it is it's not just, you know, like it's not a day job. There's a lot of discipline that goes into it to train and continually get better at the craft, even when you're a professional.
It's true. That is extremely true. We've touched on the fact that I really haven't been technically a professional for very many years. I've continued my training from Oberlin onwards for, you know, nearly 10 years. I always joke and say that I have the equivalent education of a doctor. But I don't get an MD at the end of my name, and I certainly don't get that paycheck when I get out of my fellowship that I did, you know, or residency program. But I went through all that similar training, and it was a lot of hard work, and I grew a lot exponentially with every experience. But yeah, it's a constant learning experience,
which
is good.
For you as an opera singer, what's the top of the mountain? I mean, for you, is it to be a star, an opera star? Is it to be constantly in rep? Like, what is it about, you know, what is the sort of holy grail that you're reaching
for? Me personally, I don't have any kind of flighty aspirations. You know, I think some people think that you have, quote unquote, made it when you sing at the Met in New York or at La Scala in Milan. And I know a lot of people, lots of my friends, Oberlin graduates as well, that have sung at the Met and are doing well and are successful. And I have not done that yet. And I am fine with that. I may never do that. And I'm also fine with that. I really, really, really want to be a professional singer. And I would like to continue in that for as long as I can. And so wherever that leads me is really okay by me. It does not have to be at some, you know, colossally awesome place. Although I will say the caveat on that is I am a Chicago girl and I want to sing at the Lyric.
Daniel, how about you? I mean, when you think about your work, you know, you talked about getting into administration, but let's talk about just the art as a pianist. What's the top of the heap for you as, you know, as a kid who's just finishing up at Oberlin? Look at yourself at 40, 45 years old. Like, what do you see?
I'm from Chicago and I love the city, and especially the arts community in the city, I think is fantastic. And I would love to just sort of embed myself in that. And again, just like sort of be in this position where I can be presenting music to a lot of people. And there's such fascinating things going on here to like befriend those people, see what they're doing, you know, sort of bounce ideas off of there, and just be part of this great arts community in Chicago is ideal for me.
That's ideal. I like that.
Yeah.
Daniel Hutzinger is a current student at Oberlin, both the college and the conservatory. Marcy Stonikas, opera singer who is a graduate of Oberlin. Thank you both for coming in and talking tonight on The Download. Well, that's going to do it for The Download. Patty Vasquez coming up next, live from Springfield. I believe she's in Springfield. I saw a picture today from WGN Mike. Anyway, she's coming up. A huge day tomorrow. The budget address down in Springfield. There'll be a lot of scurrying. A lot of lawmakers scurrying from their office to the chamber and back to the office. And maybe they'll stop and go to the cafeteria and scurry back. Oh, man. It'll be crazy. I mean, we'll have the speech. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. Like, I think it's a 12 o'clock start. I'm not sure how they do it. It's either 11 or 12. I can't remember off the top of my head how they do them every year. I've gone down to Springfield before and done the show pre and post, and it is a lot of scurrying. And I have a great story real quick where one time I went down there for a budget address and there was a protest, right? And it was a protest, and I forgot the group, but It was someone who was protesting cuts, right? And where we were supposed to set up in the rotunda, like they give you a certain spot mm-hmm. and you cannot change. That's the spot you're at. Was like where they set up like the roast beef sandwiches. And no one had told them. So they just set it up and there was a line of people who were getting their free sandwiches for the protest. That was like 250 people. And I'm like, excuse me, we have like 20 minutes to set up our table and our broadcast. And so roast beef sandwiches were on the other side. And the broadcast was on the others. It was probably the most chaotic moment I've had. And I do remember going, those sandwiches look good. Yeah, I have one of those sandwiches. But yeah, tomorrow is always fun. Budget address is always fun. So that's coming up. Patty Vasquez will be talking about Springfield, I'm sure, coming up as she broadcasts live from the Capitol.